is Wednesday, March 25th, 1992. Are we on teleconference now?
For 5:28.
It'll be second. We have Corman, Representatives Moyer, Baker, Miller, and Cabina. On the agenda today is House Bill. Oh, by the way, the time is 8:44. We have on the agenda today, House Bill 420 relating to contracting for care of prisoners. House Bill 465 relating to recycling solid waste management plans. House Bill 493 relating to registering the vote in polling place. House Bill 528 relating to public works contracts, wage increases. House Bill 565 relating to appropriation contract settlement costs. HDR 3 relating to change of terms from representatives to 4 years. Senate Bill 185 relating to the Legislative Ethics Act. And Senate Bill 337 relating to the retirement incentive program. I'd like to hear Senate Bill 337 first. We've had this bill before us. We will not be moving the bill out today, but we do have some people to testify on the bill. Trina Richardson. Good morning, Trina.
Good morning, Senator Cabina.
Representative.
And thank you for offering.
Knowing the future, I can
okay.
tell.
Thank you for offering us the opportunity to be here today. I'm here as a representative of NEA Alaska and also of the Kenai Peninsula Education Association. We'd like to encourage your committee to send this bill out with a due pass. We feel very strongly that we're looking for cost-effective measures for school districts to save money right now. We feel that this is a very fair, cost-effective measure. It's fair for the school employees, it's fair for university employees and other public employees, and it's also fair to the employers. In my particular district, we have several teachers who have really been working hard on the passage of this bill and feel very strongly about it, and we believe that it can offer a good incentive to districts if they choose to participate for a budget-saving item. Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any questions of the committee? Thank you, Jim. We also have Pat Jacobson. Pat?
Good morning. My name is Pat Jacobson. I'm from Kodiak. I too represent NEA Alaska. We strongly encourage the passage of this bill. As my predecessor said a moment ago, it's something that when we're looking ever increasingly towards cost-saving measures, this is certainly the right direction to be taking. It's something that is fair both to the employer and to the employee, and ultimately it gives the employer the right to opt out if they so choose. So as far as I can see, there's really nothing, no reason not to pass such a bill. And I thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Is there anyone else that had any comments on 337? Hearing none, the chair's intention to hold this bill and reschedule it for Monday. The reason for holding this bill is probably purely political, beyond our control, in dealings with the House and the Senate and leadership on movement of bills, and we'll allow them to deal with that, but I believe this bill will get a favorable recommendation. Next on the agenda, and also for teleconference, we have House Bill 528 relating to public works contracts, wage increases. House Bill 528 would require wage adjustments for certain contracts for public construction. So the Labor and Commerce, CS, in front of you.
Representative Donnelly has another bill that's being heard right now. Perhaps we could go to public testimony first and he'll be here momentarily.
That's a good idea. Phil, are you online on the teleconference?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Phil. Would you state your name, address, and who you're representing, and give us your testimony, please?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, my name is Phil Finkstad. I'm a business manager for Carpenters Local 1281 and also representing the Western Alaska Building and Construction Trades. Address is 407 Denali, phone number 276-3533. I am speaking in favor of House Bill 528. I think it, in the long run, a bill like this is going to save the state money. It disappoints me to see DOT tack on a fiscal note to it, because what happens in the current industry is the contractors who bid these projects, not knowing exactly what the wage structures will be over the life of the contract, especially on longer contracts, have to bid in a certain amount of contingency money to take care of those things. If they do not receive wage increases, as they have not for the last 8 or 9 years, then that's extra money that they profit. However, if they get caught, as they did this year, with the first wage increase in the building and construction industry, basically in the last 8 or 9 years, if they don't have enough contingency money in there, then they lose their shorts. If 528 passes, then they don't have to add those extra contingency monies into their bids. And in the long run, I personally believe, and I truthfully do so, believe that it will save the state of Alaska money. So therefore, I would urge that you pass 528. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Do we have anyone here from the administration on this bill who would like to?
For the record, my name is Lauren Rasmussen. I'm chief of design and construction. For the record, my name is Lauren Rasmussen. I'm chief of our design and construction standards department of transportation. The Department of Transportation is opposed to the bill. We think it's a major shift in the department in the long-term policies we've had for the state of assigning the risk of any increases to contractors, be they for labor, fuel, materials, transportation, whatever it is. Those costs and risks are assigned to the contractor, and we believe that this is a major shift in the policy and do not support it. The other thing is we also see that in many ways the contractors in their negotiations and their associations negotiate the wage increases. So in some ways they control those increases. In addition, they determine the productivity on the jobs, the size of crews and how productive they are. So they would be controlling their costs. And any increases, they have a better chance of controlling that than any of the state. We think it's a major change in policy, and would oppose the bill.
Well, explain to me, this bill, as I read it, would require the state to increase a payment to a contractor if the wage rate is required to be increased, and that wage rate would be required to be increased by the government, in essence, although federal government probably.
No.
No, explain that.
There's a major difference between the way the state of Alaska's Little Davis-Bacon wages work and the federal Davis-Bacon Act works. At the time of the bid opening, we put in the contract the Davis-Bacon requirements, which are the federal wage rates, and they are constant throughout that project. The state of Alaska's Little Davis-Bacon Act requires that we publish it at the time of the bid opening, and any time during the life of the contract that there's an increase, that the contractor then is responsible for the increases.
All right, well, my question is, and so I'm not real familiar with the subject, how does that wage rate get increased? Who determines that increase?
The wages are increased by surveys put out by the Department of Labor, who go out and survey to see what the prevailing wages are by what the contractors are paying. And based upon those surveys, they determine what we call a predetermined wage scale, or the Little Davis-Bacon wage rates. The government doesn't really determine those wage rates. They determine them, in essence, from the data that they get from contractors. But the contractors are setting the wages themselves through negotiations, through what they pay their employees. And the government is just looking at what's actually being paid by contractors, and then from that they determine what is the prevailing wage, and then put that out as the rate that's to be paid for each one of the classes. So in essence, the contractors are setting the wage rates by through their negotiations, through what they pay the contract, the employee out there. Then the government, through the state of Alaska Department of Labor, goes out and surveys those and determines what really is the wages, and then they publish those. And sometimes there's increases and sometimes there's decreases.
Sam Greenberg.
Isn't the question really a question of who eats the loss?
I don't really see it that way. I think it's an assignment of risk, whether it goes up
well,
or down.
Well, let's not quibble over words. Let's call it an assignment of risk.
Yes.
The question is, where should the risk be assigned?
Mm-hmm.
And why should the risk be assigned to the little contractor rather than the state?
Well, I think that's a question that we always put in the contracts, the risks that are borne by the contractors, whether it's for increases in taxes. You know, you increase the taxes here in the state, and contractors have to anticipate those, whether they're transportation, labor, whatever it is.
Well, you know, we hear from, let's say, the oil industry on the necessity for a stable state policy. Isn't this just another permutation of the same principle?
Well, the state policy for a long time has assigned those risks to the contractors. It would be a very big change in state policy.
I understand. It would be a change. How big it would be, I don't know. But the point being a question of fairness, isn't it? And if we want to encourage development, and this administration does want to encourage development, and you have an unstable policy, doesn't that discourage development?
We don't quite see it that way, obviously.
But others might they not?
Yes, they can see it that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions, committee? All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's some more. Rip Sam Donnelly is still not with us, so I think we'll have some more comments from him shortly. Henry Springer, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Mr. Springer, would you like to add some words of wisdom on this bill?
I don't know if I can add any more wisdom, but maybe some more information.
Who are you representing today, Henry?
My name's Henry Springer. I'm manager for Associated General Contractors Chapter for Alaska. It's about a 600-member service organization consisting of general and specialty contractors. We have already testified previously in support of House Bill 528 through written testimony by Richard Kavanaugh. I think that is in your files. I want to address a couple things, one of them based on the information you got from the Department of Transportation. First off, my understanding is that it has picked up a fiscal note in the ridiculous sum of $1.6 million. And whoever prepared that should seriously consider early retirement program. The way I understand it, they used the federal capital program for 1 year to the tune of $228 million and attached in a percentage to it. That is completely erroneous, and it is not the way things are going. So I would like to address two things. One of them, the assertion that the major shift in departmental policy, and what Mr. Rasmussen said is only partially true. Generally, contractors have to assume certain risks. That is part of the business. And in normal public works contracts, you have three major components: labor, equipment, and materials. And certainly there are fluctuations in market conditions in all components, especially in larger scale and long-term projects. However, what he said is not true. In nearly all cases, for example, materials, are tied down in the bidding process with quote guarantees. fees for the different components by suppliers and subcontractors. And the same is true for equipment. If you have major shifts that come up because of a volatile market situation, for example, like it has been over the last two decades in petroleum-related items like asphalt or oils and fuels, the government has recognized that it is unfair to pass those risks on and have put escalating clauses into the contracts when those shifts occur because of world markets or political situations. Then they allow compensation for that. And that is true all the way through. So even so there are inherent risks, for example, about taxation and so on, the contractors very well safeguard themselves in the equipment and materials components through binding quotations in the bidding process, which have to be upheld for the duration of the project. Now, we want to do a similar thing in labor. The labor situation, of course, is addressed already in the federal aid contracts, where the Davis-Bacon wage rates are set and then hold for the duration of the process. And I think it is inherently fair to do the same thing on the state and local level. The way it originally worked was the Department of Labor would, under the Little Davis-Bacon Act, make surveys and similarly set wages. But that has not happened over the last few years. It has happened in an inconsistent manner, sometimes through mail-out, sometimes through task forces, and sometimes through surveys. Well, the Department of Labor directly went out. I think I'm not trying to blame the Department of Labor. It is just simply cutting the wages that don't allow them to do those surveys in a manner the way it was 10 and 15 years ago. I think in order to understand that the fiscal note is very wrong, it needs to be re-examined, is that the owner pays one way or another. The owner pays either through an increased risk in which the contractor, at least the responsible contractor, tries to predict what the fluctuations in the labor market are and takes it up in their bid. Some of the fly-by-nighters don't do that. They give you a bid no matter what, and then they try to make that up through claims or through other mechanisms. So there's a lot to be said to have such stability, and I think that the state would come out just like Mr. Thickstad said. I think probably the state would break even and maybe come out ahead if those risk factors are minimized, because it puts everybody on the same footing and it does not cost more. The other thing in regard to the labor market is in some periods we have a high degree of stability because there are master agreements that cover 3 or 5 year periods in effect. And even so, some of the contracts are on the project level and not on the statewide master agreement level. Nevertheless, they usually set a trend. And as a consequence, for those eras or those periods where those master agreements are in effect, there is very little movement in the wage rate because they are already predictable. But for some unions or some workforces, they are not in effect, and that's when those mechanisms take place. I have not touched the matter of open shop contractors, which are where the labor force is not represented by collective bargaining agreements, and they, of course, can fluctuate very wildly. And so here again, it points that the mechanisms that's suggested in House Bill 528 is warranted, and I think is in the best interest of the owner, the state, local government, the unions, the workforce, and the contractors. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to react.
Thank you, Mr. Springer. Are there questions for Mr. Springer from the committee? Representative Gruber.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Henry, can you hear me?
Yes,
Okay, good. Dick Cotnock did a comment paper that we've just been faxed. And do you have that's one page? Do you have that in front of you?
Yes.
Okay, in the fourth paragraph, he recommends 3 amendments. Would you go over the, or is he going to testify?
No, he is not. He is not here. First, we would recommend that the state publish a list of prevailing wages at a certain predetermined dates. That, of course, ties in right with what I have said. It that is achievable, that is up to the Department of Labor, and they may have internal mechanisms where it's hard for them to comply with that. But there's no question, if you have predetermined check marks, it'd be both for the labor unions and for the contractors a good thing. The second thing was you would recommend that the bill include an effective date of October 1, 1991 to coincide with the Department of Labor's latest modification to the prevailing rates. That was in reaction to an errata sheet number 8, where the Department of Labor determined that wage rates had changed, and that created a problem for some of the trades because there's a dispute about what's happening in reality and what has been agreed on in the master agreement. It would take care of that. It would be not a high cost item, and it would take care of a problem. We are working with the Department of Labor on it, but as you know, there was for a long time no commissioner, and even so, there's a new commissioner on board right now. We were not able to resolve that yet. It's not a high-profile item in relation to the total bill, but it would solve that problem.
How about the Third Amendment?
The third, the agency responsible for the project should be charged with the responsibility of notifying the contractor of the new prevailing rates. These changes could be made at a minimal cost to the state and would provide orderly procedure for processing changes in the future. That is pretty reasonable. It ties in. It's a procedural thing. Right now, some of the determinations come out quite late in the process, and it just would say, well, if those things come instead of dealing with two agencies, it would be done with the owner agency.
Fine. I'm going to ask Representative Donnelly, who's joined us, and the state to comment on those proposed amendments, because they certainly seem reasonable to me. Thank you very much, Mr. Springer.
Before we do that, thank you, Henry. Is there any other questions from the committee of Henry?
No.
Not. We'll get you a copy of that. Representative Donnelly, why don't you give us a brief overview of why the need for this bill and the problems that has brought it about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it's, I imagine the committee's pretty aware of it by now. The situation is that when the Davis-Bacon rate is adjusted by the Department of Labor, all the existing contractors out there are forced with the question of having either to continue, they're forced to raise their wage rates that they pay. And since these adjustments occur at infrequent times, there's no way to know exactly when the Department of Labor will adjust these. It's impossible for them to anticipate them in their original bids. The way the industry works, they probably wouldn't do it anyway if they knew it was coming. It's so competitive with the bid process because they couldn't know how much it would be. So it'd be such an unknown, it probably wouldn't be rolled into the bid process anyhow. So when a wage rate is adjusted, they're required by law to pay that new wage rate, but they don't receive any additional compensation from the state. So the state's mandating an increased cost without any increased compensation for that cost that they're required to pay by law. It's a rather unusual situation. It's unfair to the contractors, and it also puts a unnecessary strain on the contractor's relationship with the workers, too. So this would just say that when the state's requiring wages to go up, that the state would pay the extra cost for those wages on a public works contract. And in the converse, Mr. Chairman, if there was a reduction in wages, which does occur occasionally, especially in the boom and bust market we have here, very rarely, but occasionally, the adjustment would go down. And in fact, the bill now provides that the amount saved would be adjusted in the contract.
For the record, we should note that we were joined by Representative Greenberg just minutes after we started, and we've been joined by Representative Bruckman and Choquette. So, from your discussion, Representative Donnelly, it appears that their first recommendation may be one that would be a good one for everybody. Mm-hmm. If we did set a set time that that was going to be reviewed?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that, in working with the Department of Labor on their budget subcommittee over the years, I know that they would, they should speak for themselves, but in the past, I think they sought the flexibility to, be able to assess those when they thought it was necessary. If you were to make them go through a regular procedure, we might have a pretty good fiscal note on this bill. I don't know what they're going to say to that.
May I inquire on that point?
Representative Greenberg?
Yeah. I certainly have no problem with them doing things as it becomes necessary, but this would be, what we would say is they would normally, let's say, do it annually, and at other times in their discretion. I mean, it's not to preclude them from doing it other times, but that they would at least publish this annually.
Does anyone hear from the Department of Labor?
I, looking down at number three here, the agency responsible should be charged with the notifying. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I don't see any problem with that one. Number two caused me a fiscal note concern, too.
Do you have a comment on Department of Transportation's fiscal note in here?
Well, I know it's a whopper, isn't it? I've in talking the testimony at the last committee from the private sector was they didn't think it was going to be this much. I can understand why transportation would be concerned about it, wanting to do as many projects as possible. The cost here, becomes a question. Even if it was this, it's not necessarily going to be an additional cost to the state as much as it may be a little bit less we could do someplace else. But I think that's an appropriate a cost of doing business to have the fairness in the marketplace in dealing with your contractors. There's also a lot of testimony in prior committees, I don't know if this committee's heard it, that with this understanding that the more enlightened contractors and the ones that are more effective in bidding, which tend to be the ones that get the bids, might be able to adjust their contracts to remove some uncertainty in the process. But it really would be up to the AGC would know more about that, but they did make the argument last time that they would have a high degree of sophistication enough that they would see that now they had more certainty and they wouldn't have to worry about the uncertain and have a bigger slush in their contracts. It's hard to know. It's really hard to know because I know there's some contractors that aren't sophisticated enough to take that in as a factor, and there's others that are very sophisticated and may very well lower their bids because of this.
Senator Bruckman and then Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to say that it had come through the Labor and Commerce Committee that I sat on, and that I see it as protection not only for the workers to receive a prevailing wage, but for the contractor, too, so the adjustments can be made so the contractor makes a fair profit margin from the bid that they gave, in reestablishing that price. So it was, in my opinion, considered as something that was fair to both the contractors, the employer and the employee, on having a fair margin of profit and income from the work done. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Representative
Miller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, it's unfortunate the Department of Labor isn't here, but it looks like the last time that they've done a prevailing wage survey was October 1st, 1991, according to what we've got here. Do you have any idea how often they do these things?
It's a mixed bag. Sometimes they do them fairly close together, and when they think that a particular category of work has changed dramatically, other times they don't do them for a while. It's really a focus of where the need is or what the perceived need is.
I would be nice to have a Department of Labor here, but and I'm not in the contracting business, but I've filled out survey forms in retail trade before from the U.S. Department of Labor, and there it's a survey form, how many people you have working, what's the prevailing wage, how much you pay this person. And I don't know if it's basically that type of form that they use with the contractors or not. But, I do see some merit in that First Amendment. I don't think we necessarily would be quarterly or semi-annually, but I do see some merit in doing it once a year. I really do. So everybody knows what the playing field is out there.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I see that too, but we've already got one department opposing this bill.
Well, we can certainly bring the Department of Labor in here and get an idea what they think, Representative Greenberg.
Let's look at the DOT fiscal. Let's assume that their figures are correct and that the value of this bill is 1.647 million. Then wouldn't it follow that that's what it's costing the contractors if we don't pass the bill?
And Donnelly?
Yes, it would.
Secondly, looking at the first page of the fiscal note, the source of the funds, it looks to me like the vast majority of the funds are federal funds. So the money comes from the federal government anyway, doesn't it?
Certainly DOT's, most of their construction is federal bill.
Thank you.
I get another one to testify, Ed Flanagan. Pull up another chair there, Dave. I can have James's chair.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mr. Flanagan, the Alaska District Council of Laborers, also speaking today for the Alaska AFL-CIO. Just briefly, I believe our former Deputy Commissioner Springer of DOT spoke well to their fiscal note. I'd also like to associate myself with Bill Thingstead's remarks and just give an example of how this would work and provide cost savings. The Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, it was a 3 to 4 year project, and if the wages had been locked in for that time, there was the potential for 4 year stagnation and a chilling effect on negotiations. The contracts for Bradley Lake, however, under the Energy Authority, had a escalator clause. It went up and down, and there were a lot of wage changes during that period of that construction. Most of them were down. There was one major wage increase or total package increase for the Boilermakers, which were a very proportionally very small portion of the job. And the contractor, which had that work, then executed a change order when the rates changed, when they were changed by the Department of Labor, and the contractor was reimbursed accordingly. The culinary contractor, their wages or total package went down nearly a dollar at one point, about midway through the project. Their change orders were executed and their total contract amount reduced to reflect the savings that they had. There were several other changes which were minor. Most crafts had to shift money off the paycheck onto the benefits to keep up health, and there were change orders for those also since the overtime multiplier no longer applied. I think everybody's aware that Bradley was a good project, came in ahead of schedule, basically under budget, and while I would certainly hope as a building tradesman that the trends are up in the next few years, because as Mr. Thingstead mentioned, we have had stagnation for 9 years. DOT puts a lot of emphasis on the responsibility of the contractors to control wages. I would submit that they have done so with a vengeance. They have kept the wages down for 9 years, and in their behalf, I would also say their profit margins are down in the last 9 years due to the increased competition that our large capital budgets of the early 80s drew when the lower 48 construction economy was very flat. And I think to make them pay the wage increases, which are a matter of good public policy, the Davis-Bacon Act goes back to 1931 on the federal level. We certainly support that. We think that the wages should be paid when they're changed, but we don't think it's fair to make the contractors take it out of their profit margins and that they should be made whole through change order. And the state does stand to gain in times when wages go down.
Thank you, Mr. Flanagan. Do you think that some of the amendments, the three amendments have been proposed by the General Contractor Association would be beneficial or detrimental or really you're neutral on them? Any thoughts?
Well, I've only seen these. Well, I guess I did hear them in the Labor and Commerce Committee. I had not really seen the written comments by Mr. Catnock. The first, I'm not sure what the intent was or how you would do that with this bill. That's basically, I believe, administrative policy of the Department of Labor. It's my understanding that they shoot for an annual survey. If they can do an informal, and I don't mean to speak for them, but if they don't believe there's significant changes out there, I believe sometimes due to budgetary constraints they might skip a year. But there's the issue of increases during the term, between, if you set an annual date that you would prevail wages. Well, there are contract changes and negotiated, and the union has to show that it prevails, that it represents a majority of the workforce out there in those classifications in order for its wages to be prevailed. So I know there might be some moves to try and limit that. If it was, I would just say that it would have to be more than annually. Otherwise, you could have people working 11 months at the lower wage rate. As far as the second, I think that would help some contractors and capture increases that have happened since October 1st. And I don't know what that will do to the fiscal note, but it would certainly be fair. And as far as the third, I know at the Energy Authority, and I believe all eight contracting agencies, I think they already do that. I know DOT could speak to that, but I believe they already have to notify the contractors when there are wage increases.
Questions, committee? All right, thank you, Mr. Miley. House State Affairs Committee would like to welcome former Lieutenant Governor Steve McAlpine.
Is he going to testify?
He can testify if he wants on anything he'd like.
The only thing I testify to, Dave, is the Steve's road you're missing.
What's the wishes of the committee?
Skiing is great. As
far as moving on amendments.
Is there a desire to deal with amendments? Is there a
yes.
Desire?
Yes.
I'm looking for motions. Representative Greenberg.
I move that you have a, that we have a proposed CS prepared and brought back to the committee so we can see the form of the amendments, and that would give time for Representative Donnelly to look at it in the Department of Labor too. But this is just sort of conceptual, and I would further request
for all
that,
three of them.
And I'd further and do it on an annual basis for number one, and I'd further request that a copy be sent up to Mr. Cadnock and Mr. Springer so they can see it too, and anybody else
in the Department of Labor.
Yeah, sure. Let's circulate it around so they see what we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Shokat. I'd request the Department of Labor be here at the next meeting.
Mm-hmm. Demand it?
I can't demand it.
I can't, but I can.
Subpoena.
Any other comments?
Is there a date certain you're going to
do? They smell blood today, right?
We actually have a confirmation hearing on Friday that I don't expect will take the whole time, since we don't have three books like we did on the last Commissioner of Administration. So we can just hold this till Friday.
Sure.
All right, you, Representative Donnelly? We shall do so.
Mr. Sherman,
would you please?
No.
Well, thank you on the teleconference line. Going off
teleconference.
Yeah, Donnelly seems to bring him in.
Just for the for the audiences, so you know what we're doing in case we don't are not going to take up a bill that's on here. We will not be hearing House Bill 493 today, nor will we be hearing House Bill 565 today. So if you were waiting for one of those, they are not going to be discussed. Let's talk about House Bill 420. We had this bill before us last week. We had a CS done. I'd like to hand it back here to make sure I'm doing it. 420. Annie, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, please. What I'd like on House Bill 420 is a motion to rescind our action and adopting committee substitute for the last meeting. And passing the bill out, that's good. All right, there is a motion to rescind our action and adopt any committee substitute and passing the bill out. Are there objections to that? Hearing no objections. Maybe I should have read this first. Legal discovered some problems with the draft of the bill. The Department of Law and Department of Corrections have drafted and see us correct the problems. You should have had a legal opinion dated March 20th from Kerry Bannister. And attached to it is a CS, and then we should also have a CS.
I don't see it.
Well, it's not in a bill form. It's this.
I don't, we must have taken it offline. And I don't seem to have a copy.
I don't have a copy.
Yeah, my stuff's not.
It's right there. Okay.
The draft?
Yeah.
Oh, I have that.
Do you have an extra copy?
Legal opinion is by Terry Bannister. Is that correct? Michael Stark.
I have Michael Stark.
Yeah.
I don't have Terry Bannister.
I think we took it.
I took it around.
You must have had it. Yeah.
This is the memo, the one that looked, the yellow, this is the Bannister, that's the Stark.
I'm looking at Bannister.
This is sort of easy.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Do you need a motion to adopt this for discussion?
Well, I want to make sure I'm right on here. All right. Well, this was a confusing issue. We had a Department of Law opinion. We had our alleged legal opinion. And Division of Corrections needs to learn to write a bill. She's coming over, right?
Yes.
On her way. Am I correct in saying, then, Annie, what we really want to do is adopt this CS? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we adopt the work draft for HB 420, the one dated 3.492.
All right, there is a motion to have a CS in front of us. It's in the form of a work draft by the Department of Corrections dated 3.492.
Mr. Chairman, Jeff, for the purpose of discussion, I just got this. It looks like Terry Bannister's version is different.
It is different because this was done later.
Oh.
Than the Bannister version, and to be honest, Max, you're going to have to help us.
May I make a request?
Maybe we leave this to the end of the agenda.
May I make a request, Mr. Chairman? Are you going to have anybody testify on this one?
She's on her way up here.
If we could take testimony today, and I'd request the personal courtesy of holding this over until Friday so I can review it, and then we can have our letter too, deal with the whole thing and do it right. But let's take the testimony today so we know what's going on here.
Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate that too. I find this subject extremely confusing and multifaceted. It's that one person's statement seems to counteract what I just read.
Yeah.
Well, but the problem is Representative Schiff, they don't have their act together on the it's not our fault.
I would request who's ever doing the chair in that subcommittee to set a time so that we can meet tomorrow at some point and deal with this.
That's
what we need, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
And if this could be all referred to the subcommittee so we can look at the whole thing and really see what's, maybe even just deal with it in the subcommittee so we don't take everybody else's time and then have it up on Friday.
Tomorrow afternoon,
perhaps.
Yeah. I'll get with you.
Sure.
Okay. But I want to hear her.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Can Representative Ruffin be the chair?
Mm-hmm.
I think
you leave it right there, so we'll come right back to it. Let's take House Bill 465. House Bill 465 is relating to recycling and solid waste management. We begin developing a procurement plan by state agencies for recycled products. Representative Ballmer was here earlier. I asked and told her that we could not take the bill up at the beginning, so she has left.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Caleb Stewart, intern of Representative Elmer's office is here.
Caleb.
Members of the committee. This is a procurement and recycling plan. Basically, what's going on is landfill space in the in our state and the Northwest is becoming less and less available, harder to use. Standards coming down that are discouraging use of landfills. Other methods of getting rid of our waste must be found. Recycling is one of them. Representative Ulmer has become a member of an organization called PENWAR, the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, is studying various ways of dealing with concerns common to the Northwest region. One of them is disposing of waste, and recycling is one of them. This bill is her attempt at getting the state of Alaska to participate with that group and setting some standards and encouraging recycling here in Alaska. This bill will direct the Department of Environmental Conservation to do a characterization of the waste generated here in Alaska by state agencies and make that data available, collect it and correlate it to make it available, decide what kind of products, waste out of that can be used for recyclable. Department of Administration will take some of that information, use it for developing plans to increase purchases of products by state agencies of recycled products. Department of Transportation, as a major purchasing agency of the state of Alaska, has been identified as a separate from Department of Administration for doing the same thing. And to their credit, they've been working hard on this already as one initiative. And have the Department of Commerce and Economic Development put together possible marketing plans, make this information available to private individuals and corporations in the state, and allow them to look at the possibilities using some of our waste material generating recycled products, and then overall encourage the state of Alaska as a major purchasing agent to increase its purchases of recycled products. See if we can't handle our waste material here in the state in a more ecologically sound fashion than throwing it away. Be happy to answer any questions.
Talking about recycling certain teams, sir? Especially since we're only in the NCAA finals.
Yeah, fiscal note.
Yeah, it would be a bunch of them.
Just sure you ought to strike those comments from the record.
Hey, that DOT doesn't have a fiscal note on this one. Commerce has a fiscal note.
See one
system. Like I said, Commerce,
223,000.
Do you have any questions, Caleb?
Beg your pardon?
Does the committee have any questions? Sponsor?
Yeah, I do have a question on this
one.
Maybe you could tell me, if we purchase recycled products, are they more or less expensive than regular?
More.
Well, some of them can be more, some can be less. As far as agency-wide goes, you know, there's the possibility of buying recycled products that are more expensive in one area but less in the other, and they balance out overall. One of the big things coming up is that there are regulations coming down from the federal government and stuff. They're going to force the state to change its ways, and purchasing recycled products is going to be one of those weapons.
We already have incentives through the legislature to buy recycled products. This is for forcing them to recycle our stuff. You said less wear?
Sometimes.
Well, I know our printed material, when we use recycled paper, is more.
Is more,
for what?
Yeah.
Recycled paper, which...
And for letterhead?
No, I use them on brochures, Alice, he's recycled. But I know it's more.
Just on the economics, I know the things we're dealing with, political and those guys. Do those states have recycling industries in them that they are attempting to assist with this?
Yes, Washington and Oregon do.
We don't have any recycling industry really here, do we? Except for the people who pick up cans and stuff like that.
Right. And not to the extent that they're turning them into products, manufacturing.
How realistic is it for Alaska to develop a recycling industry up here? I'm interested if we can make money rather than spend money.
Unless state agencies, the state gets involved and something like this starts coming, not that realistic, to be honest with you. It's just a, you know, it's a start. This is kind of trying to get it going. At this point, the recyclers in Alaska are having a hard time making it, but they're doing it. But they're basically shipping their stuff out of state, just, you know, collecting it, sorting it, and shipping it on down, which means turning the products down south.
I guess I'd ask also the chairman of the International Trade Committee, is there any chance of us picking up any business in this area with recycled stuff from other countries or something?
Max, I never heard of anything to that effect. I don't know.
I heard, it probably wouldn't deal with this, but I've heard of a couple of possible plans on people trying to looking at loans through AIDA for recycled grains, believe it or not, and waste papers for certain
grains.
Yeah, it's
how do you recycle grain?
I don't know quite, but there's something, I mean, there's a project that they're looking for financing on that would be established in the South Central and paper using the recycled paper.
I can tell you my problem here is not bill, it's just money and, you know, the competing for money. You know, I have a bill up there I think it's more important to spend the money on. But, I mean, that's my issue, is the issue of priorities and how we're spending money. And I guess we can't deal with that issue here, but yet you just send it on to finance and...
Sure we can.
I mean, I say, you can't... If you send it on the finance and it's a very good member of the finance committee, well, we should recommend him as a sponsor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was considered in resources too. When we had it there, we fully well knew that this impacts would be, as you say, just taken care of, considered, and we got the finance.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, the Department of Environmental Conservation is going to be required by the federal government to do a study of the solid waste in the state of Alaska. For one way or the other, I mean, it's coming down. They're either going to find money in their existing budget to do it, or this note can help fund the studies that they're going to have to be doing.
Thank you. I have two other bills. Like, we have to hear something. I have two people that would like to testify on this, I believe. Or maybe not. Thank you, Caleb. Tugan Petty, do you have anything to add?
Unless you have some questions.
Who do you represent?
Department of Administration and General Services.
In essence, are you in support of this bill? The department? Do they want it, or?
Yes, we can do the recycle procurement plan. I might add, if I could, a couple of items. There's some questions about industries, potential industries, and I might just pass on that at least in two of the areas that we discussed, recycled plastic products. My understanding is that there is, and I can't tell you which because I just heard about it recently, a native corporation in the state who is purchasing the materials to begin producing recycled plastic products, which is to take recycled cups or milk jugs and so on and make plastic lumber with it. That may be a potential industry in the state. Most of that product now is made east of the Mississippi River, and it's heavy and it's expensive to ship. It handles and works just about like lumber, but has qualities to it that are actually better than lumber because it doesn't deteriorate and it doesn't leach out materials in the wetlands as would pressure treated material. So this is a potential industry in that area. latex, recycling of latex paint seems a little odd, but that is recovering a half a can of latex paint, mixing them together. We do have at least one paint manufacturing company in the state. The gentleman who operates that is not particularly interested in the idea of doing recycled paint, but there is a potential economic possibility there as well.
Thank you, Mr. Pettis. Is it Kristen Shane Johnson?
Is it Jeff Otteson?
Pardon me?
I wonder if my handwriting has confused you.
Could be.
DOT?
No. Do you want to say anything from DOT?
I have just a minute's worth.
Go ahead.
Jeff Otteson, Department of Transportation. The department basically supports the bill. We're already recycling on some fronts, in particular with recycled tires or retreaded tires. Those are less expensive. We've looked at motor oil. Generally, motor oil, for reasons we can't fathom, is more expensive, so it's not a good buy for us. Of interest, the new highway bill will require that we use milled rubber coming from old tires in our pavements, rising to 40% of our tonnage must have this additive by the year 97. So
it's a West Virginia company.
Yeah, it's actually a proprietary product right now. We do have a concern about that, but it's a national requirement. All 50 states are facing the same tonnage.
Chairman
Lance?
Is
there any similar requirement for glass and asphalt?
There's no requirement for it, and we've looked at that quite hard. There's a number of regions in this country that are using glass and asphalt. There's some interesting research out of Virginia that suggests it's probably better to use it in the base. You have a technical problem called stripping, where the asphalt tends to not want to cling to the glass aggregate. But if you put it in the base or the sub-base, those problems are gone. Yeah, there's lots of potential, and it's, you know, the testimony's right. It takes someone to sort of jumpstart the system.
Any questions? Thank you, sir. Anybody else have anything to add here on this bill? So what's the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to jumpstart the bill.
I would
move that we report the bill out to the commission.
Yes, for move that.
465 and individual recommendations.
Objections? Bill's gone. Next, I'm just so excited about the right to strike today, I'm starting to get enthused about the bills we have in front of us. Let's go 420 again. No, we're not going to get those.
Oh, our old friend.
I'm sorry, but we don't have any bills on Friday, so we'll...
Corrections. I understood that there were some questions about the bill and received a letter from the Division of Legal Services outlining their concerns about it and worked with Mike Stark and drafted a substitute that we think answers the concerns that were raised by legal services.
Have you reviewed the Bannister draft and with your draft? Do you know, can you tell us what the difference are? Or did you do these kind of at the same time and you did not?
I did this after I read the Bannister draft. And the Bannister draft took a few things out, but in her letter she raised concerns that weren't addressed in her draft, and we just tried to include those in ours. And that included the, basically just took her suggestion on the title and
hey, Diane, why don't I, just to save you some time, why don't I do this? The committee's asked for a subcommittee on this. It's going to be chaired by Representative Bruckman. Any of the members of the committee are welcome to work on this. I'd like you guys to get together tomorrow, if you could, and Representative Grunberg would like to be involved, certainly, and to go over the concerns were from our legal and how you rewrote it and how they rewrote it, and get a bill back to us on Friday that we don't have to. I'd like the committee to also consider, when you're looking at this language, that whether this is something that we allow the department to absolutely say they're going to do this, or whether it is something that may be more on a voluntary basis, because maybe there's a lot of these people who would like to leave. Anyways, I've told you my concerns. That way, I think that would be an easier way to get us a bill back that we can move on to the next committee. And then I'll just hold it over until Friday, if you guys can meet tomorrow. Can you meet tomorrow, Diane?
Sure.
Okay. Or today, you can meet anytime and have us a bill back by Friday.
I can't today.
Have Annie a bill back by tomorrow night. Okay? We have the ethics bill in front of us. I'm not going to, because of the time, I'm not going to try to bring that to us right now, so we're going to hold it over until Friday.
We should have some time on Friday.
We should. And, you know, this committee, in essence, has been chosen to be the
ethics committee
arbitrator, I guess. Of a senator and two ethics committees. Maybe that's it. To find a way to see if there's a bill that can get to the floor that we can pass, that they can have some possibility of accepting. So they'll both make short presentations to us, and I don't think they're prepared to agree yet, so I don't know what to do. I don't know. We'll probably just put it in the subcommittee and see if there's... But this committee does not have the time to spend that we spent last year on doing this bill, so we just don't. The time's running out. And I'm hopeful that next week we're going to be done with House bills. So we also have, that's 185. We also had Navarro's HJR 3. Again, maybe we can hear it on Friday, too. I'll hold it over. We have an appropriation bill, and I had... I'll just tell you up front what I'm doing. I'm asking the university to deal with the Prince William Sound College salary problem in this bill. And they are drafting some language that they said they would take care of it. If that, they'll actually do it. Well, not that I'm holding the bill hostage, but they asked me to hold it another day because they didn't have, the exact language.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gruber?
On the ethics bill, it would help me if the senator could have for us, if her staff could prepare, a list of the sections in the ethics bill that she has problems with, just simply a list of the sections so we can focus on those.
A list of the sections, well, you know, I suspect that she won't even go that far. One adjourn, so I'll get off the record. I'd like to say something.
Forward any bills.
What am I going to hold? I said,
he's already said it.
I'm going to hold 185, HJR 3, and 420, and 528, four bills.